Well, Daniel, it's a special time of year. Oscar season, as they say.
This is a great time of year.
Yeah.
End of February, I'm always looking forward to this weekend.
I think people tend to think of us in terms of, like, films from way back when, but, we watch contemporary films as well.
Oh, totally. I get shit for that all the time, especially from my wife, Mandy. She says, you just always talk about obscure movies that no one's ever seen.
Yeah. No, I'm a fan of the Oscars. I try and make it a point to watch the Oscar films.
I've been talking to some people who, and people who like film, it's not cool to like the Oscars.
Oh, yeah.
But why is that?
I don't know.
I've always liked them.
Yeah. I mean, I'll admit it. I don't watch the red carpet jazz. I don't have the patience for it.
It's the best part. You don't know what you're missing.
But this is a special time. I don't want to waste too much time with idle banter because we've got a lot to get to. And it's not even the Oscar movies themselves that I'm most excited about. It's the fact that we have with us today a very special guest. It goes by the name of Jeff Jensen. Jeff, welcome.
Oh.
Thanks for being here, Jeff.
A huge fan of your podcast, so I'm very grateful to be here.
Oh, well, thank you. For those who are heretofore unacquainted, Jeff has been a journalist for Entertainment Weekly for nearly 20 years, mostly focusing on television criticism. He's the Eisner Award-winning author of the 2011 graphic novel Green River Killer, A True Detective Story, co-wrote along with Brad Bird and Damon Lindelof the 2015 film Tomorrowland, starring George Clooney and Hugh Laurie, and in 2017, he appeared on the Freshman 15. So welcome,
woohoo,
Jeff Jensen.
I like that last credit.
What a trajectory. It's only going up.
But it's good. But in addition to all this, as we said, Oscar season, and here we are. We're heading into Oscar weekend. And Jeff, unless I'm mistaken, you are a member of the Academy.
Unfortunately, I am not a member of the Academy.
Oh, I thought you were.
But I covered the Oscars for many years at EW.
Okay.
One of my duties. Yeah, in fact, one of my favorite duties until this year, sadly, was going to the Academy on Oscar morning when the nominations are announced. And until this year, the tradition was is that they would, have the press come in at 5:30 in the morning, and we would all be there in the back of the room when they make those announcements, and then we would write down everything they say, and then we would grab a press kit, which would have everything that they just said.
Oh, wow.
So we didn't need to write it down, actually. But there was something really exciting about being in that room for those, like, white-hot 5 minutes of announcement. Right. It's like you felt like you were in the center of pop culture there.
Yeah.
And it was very difficult to get up in the morning and go, but it was one of my favorite duties.
So are people in there, like, super excited about what's going on?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Okay. So, like, in that room, in the Academy room, the Academy president and a star would get up on stage. They'd read these announcements. And then in the theater, you would have all this electronic media from every single outlet covering entertainment stuff. And then in the back of them, you would have, like, print journalists, studio publicists, personal publicists, Oscar strategists for various studios.
Whoa.
Sometimes on these press events, you could hear us cheering in the back. Not me, but like, studio publicists cheering on their clients and on stuff like that. Over the past, I would say, 7 years or so, 8 years, gone through this process of trying to improve the Oscars, trying to refine the Oscars, trying to make it more popular and more relevant to a new generation.
Wow.
And the latest evolution of that is turning Oscar nomination morning into more of a social media event, a broadcaster exclusive event. So this year, none of the press were invited. I don't know if you saw any of that on that morning, but they created all this special programming and they aired it exclusively, I think, on ABC and on social media and stuff like that.
Wow, that's an interesting change, I think.
I mean,
and by the way, I think the plan today is we want to focus specifically on the Best Picture nominees. A lot to talk about with a lot of the other categories, but Best Picture is, well, just for time's sake, is what we want to talk about the most. But this is something I wanted to ask about. 9 nominees. Maybe I'm just haven't been noticing how the world has been working, but that feels fairly unprecedented. Like I'm 9 nominees. Why?
Well, since this change occurred, I believe in 2009, 2010. Until that point, for about, I think, 50 years or so, maybe a little bit more.
Wow, so
mostly
that long.
Been 5 nominees.
5, right.
Again, around 2009... there had been a growing movement over several years that kind of built to the decision that was made in 2009. There was some disgruntlement, some frustration among big studios about what was getting nominated for Best Picture.
Okay.
There was this overwhelming feeling that a lot of big studio stuff was being ignored. with this sort of like big flashpoint for all of that being the snub of the Dark Knight in like, I think 2005, 2006, a lot of people thought that should have been nominated for Best Picture. But that became sort of this flashpoint for this larger discussion, well, mostly generated by the big studios, right, of like, why is it all this indie stuff? Yeah. What about our sort of like big franchise films? And right, and why are we supporting the Academy if the stuff that we're making has no chance of getting into the race?
Right.
That combined with a growing movement, again, by the Academy to get a bigger audience for the Oscars and make it more relevant, implemented this change where they changed the way that nominating was what would happen, and they would create a situation whereby the Best Picture category would be no fewer than 5 films,
okay,
but no more than 10. So on any given year, we will see 5 to 10 nominated.
So there's
films.
A range.
There's a range. Next year, we can have 6 films. Yeah. You know, it all depends on the vagaries of this complicated preferential voting system that they have. I think we immediately went to 10 like the first couple years.
Because I remember
that. But then
it's
coming down.
Okay,
yeah.
So it's come down.
Yeah.
Somebody did some sort of math about an Oscar nomination equals so much revenue for a movie. And that's the side of it that I kept hearing about. Like, well, it's this money thing and all that. But that's really interesting to hear that it's actually a little more complex than that.
Not everyone's a fan of it. Everyone immediately assumed, oh, great, we can have more films. Because 5 did seem to be a little severe.
Right.
And 5 did, you know, we were kind of in this moment where maybe there was a certain kind of sensibility that was being more often reflected among the nominees. But then almost immediately, as soon as we got 10, we're seeing some years where we've seen like, oh yeah, like all those 9 films, 10 films, like those were all great films. They all deserve an Oscar. But right, this year, like is a year where I think that maybe we might say, really? Like, yeah, do all of these deserve a nomination? I'm not sure.
And that's a question I definitely want to get into as we get into our list.
It changes the question for me, because maybe with 5, you think, okay, well, why was this excluded?
Right.
But now when it's a larger option, it begs the question, okay, well, why is this included?
Why is it included?
Right, exactly. Yeah.
You know what? Let's stop talking about the thing and talk about the thing.
Let's do it.
So, you know what? I say we go movie by movie.
Before you do that, Jeremy, sure, like, have you guys seen all of the films?
Yes.
I've seen all the films.
So good for you. The professional entertainment journalist in the mix here has not. So just a FYI.
Well, it's because you're slumming it in television, I guess.
That's true.
Yeah, you're watching a lot more things.
We'll start with a sci-fi film by director Denis Villeneuve. That film is Arrival, starring Amy Adams. So, Jeff, yes, did you catch Arrival? And if so, what'd you think?
I did see Arrival. I really admired Arrival for the Amy Adams performance.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of very bummed that she wasn't nominated for Best Actress in that. The direction, just the style of the whole thing. I just loved the storytelling in that. And I definitely enjoyed thinking through the concepts of time,
yeah,
that are expressed in the film and how the concept of time is very much linked to the theme of grief.
And by the way, I don't want to cut you off here, but I just want to make sure that our audience knows that we're going to try our best to be as spoiler-free as possible.
Yes.
I apologize, Jeff. Please continue.
So I'll stop there because anything more is going
to
spoil
That's
it.
That's true. That's a hard one to describe,
yeah,
right?
I mean,
it's a hard one to talk about.
Yeah. I don't know. Well, Daniel, what did you think?
I loved Arrival.
Yeah.
And I think I loved it more than I thought I would. I had no idea what it was about besides that it was about alien ships, right, coming to Earth. But I had no idea how Amy Adams' character factored in, besides that she was somehow learning the language. And I think because I went in not knowing, I loved it. So I loved this movie, except there were 2 moments that I felt pulled me out.
Right.
Otherwise, it was one of my absolute favorites from the list of the Best Picture nominees. And what you said, Jeff, I admired all those things. I loved the style and the sound. I love the camera work to me was so beautiful in that it felt like it was constantly revealing things. These different scenes or moments or seeing things. And as the camera revealed it, I kind of felt how it might be from the perspective of like Amy Adams to experience something like that for the first time. And I love that.
Yeah. Speaking of camera work, the film opens and there's other parts of the film that feature these, I'm going to call them quote unquote, quote, flashback moments. They seem to have been directed by Terrence Malick. I mean, I looked at the whole thing. In fact, to the point to where I was trying to decide if it was an asset or a distraction.
Right.
It was so Malicky.
Because you kept on making these connections to Malick in this film.
Yeah, exactly. I'm waiting for Sean Penn's voiceover or something like that. It's not to say that was an issue that I had with the movie by any stretch, because I'll be honest, I loved it also. In fact, it had all the ingredients of a film that I was completely prepared for this being my favorite film. There were a handful of things that held me back with it. For me, like, the gold standard of that kind of movie is always going to be the Zemeckis film Contact. I love that film so much. It has a lot of the same kind of elements where it's just like, you know, let's figure out the communication method and all that. But what Contact did that I wish Arrival had done, Contact kind of gave us that aha, oh, that's the puzzle piece that helps us to understand. And there wasn't really ever that moment, and I wanted there to be. It's just, you know, we know that Amy Adams is trying to communicate with these alien beings, and it is figured out how to communicate, or at least what's being said.
Yes.
But it's never really like a moment of realization. It's just like, okay, we did some homework, and, you know, that's so that I wanted a little bit more, but the big ideas were really, really inspiring. It wasn't my favorite of the nominees, but a great film.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that holds me back on that movie is when I said I enjoyed thinking through it. But the problem is that, you know, it invites you to think it through. And then I think that if you start thinking about it too deeply, it runs the risk of kind of falling apart on you, especially concerning some of the things that we can't talk about.
Right.
The high concept in it, like, it, you start going, does that make sense? Does that add up? I don't know. So
yeah, there's a reveal with a supporting character in it that, I'll be honest, I saw that coming way early. It felt like that reveal was so drawn out to me because I'm like, I know what you're getting at. Just go ahead and show us, you know. But that, you know, that's a tough thing with films, because you don't want to give too little and you don't want to give too much. You don't want the audience to feel shortchanged when there's a twist or something like that.
So. Yeah, and I think the tone really spoke to me and it kind of drew me in. So I didn't need much of that other stuff. So then, like when you said, when it did feel drawn out, or you do start to think about it, or it does simply become about ideas, then you have to think about them. They end up breaking down. And the film becomes about those other things that I don't think it does as well as the things that I felt like really connected me to it.
Let's move on to the next film, directed by a guy I think you might have heard of. His name is Denzel, and he put together a film called Fences.
I loved the writing. I mean, I guess that's important to name. It's based on a play by August Wilson.
Right.
And so he also wrote the screenplay. That's what it felt like to me. It actually felt like a film that was based on a play. Yeah. And so therefore, these long monologues and these speaking scenes were very moving because of the writing. I'm not sure all the elements that it takes to make a film clicked for me. I felt like Denzel's character was a really great character. Viola Davis, I thought her character was wonderful. Some supporting cast I didn't feel too strongly about. And the direction was fine. For me, there was a big question. Why is this up for Best Picture? Because certainly, I think it should be up for Best Adapted Screenplay. I think Denzel certainly deserves a nomination for Best Actor. And I think Viola Davis, was she also nominated?
I'm not sure. Was she?
Yes, she's nominated for Best Supporting Actress.
Okay, so that's great. But there were a few things that I thought were missing. I'm like, I don't know why this was nominated.
Right. Did you catch it, Jeff?
No. No. I have this on a screener.
Yeah.
And it is next in line for me to watch.
Well, I mean, I agree. Really powerful film. In fact, really every nominated film this year was, at the very least, a good movie. About a year ago, I was involved with a community theater production of A Raisin in the Sun, which is an all African-American cast. And I had no idea until I was talking with the cast of this play how important Fences is to the African-American community, specifically the African-American theater community. It's just... It's a revered work.
Really? So you would talk about this?
Yeah. In fact, and I hadn't even heard of it, to be honest, before I participated in A Raisin in the Sun.
I hadn't even heard of it until the film. I didn't know it was a play.
It's kind of a high stakes proposition to adapt this play into a movie. And I couldn't help it the whole time. I was wondering, does this movie do the play justice? Now, I can't claim to have seen it on stage. That was the push and pull that I kept experiencing. You know, I like this. This is interesting. These characters are really compelling. I kind of wish I were watching this on stage instead of on a screen, though.
That was my exact feeling about it as well.
I haven't seen it, but I've read a lot about it. And I've read a lot of discussion about whether or not Denzel Washington's direction of this film, his approach to it. A lot of people criticize it for feeling not very cinematic, for not kind of like conquering the challenge of how do you take a theatrical experience and make it a cinematic experience. But on the other hand, I've heard other defenses of his direction as saying, no, on the contrary, kind of like by leaning into, I would say, maybe the claustrophobia mm-hmm. of that, you capture that central experience of his character, Denzel Washington's character, as being trapped, as being fenced in
yeah.
by life and history passing him by. That it works for the film.
That does make a lot of sense, because when you look at the film, it takes place in the backyard, and then it takes place yes. in the living room, and then the backyard, and then the kitchen, and then the backyard. My impression was, I felt like I was essentially probably watching the play,
right.
just with a few odds and ends.
What you said, Jeff, actually makes me appreciate the film more. I was thinking that the final shot is something that I'm like, oh, it almost makes sense to make a film for this shot. And I kept on thinking, how would they have conveyed this in the theater? Like, what seems to be being said, at least through that shot? And it made me grateful for that moment. Okay, I couldn't have seen this anywhere else but here.
So, another actor, director, a guy that I'm sure we've all heard of, named Mel Gibson, who put together a film called Hacksaw Ridge. Just from a true story point of view, a reporting of this is what happens, already you've got gold. With
it's
Hacksaw
incredible.
Ridge.
It
is an amazing tale. Desmond Doss, Seventh-day Adventist conscientious objector, but he won, it was the Congressional Medal of Honor
yeah.
that he won for bravery, for valor on the battlefield.
For
World
being
War
a II. Medic.
Yeah, amazing. The premise of the movie, even in itself, is this sort of swollen heart, tearjerker premise. Refused to touch a weapon, to pick up a weapon, and yet somehow became one of the most key players in this battle because of all the lives that he rescued on his own side. Really, it's not even the kind of movie where...
There's no twist.
No, there's no twist or surprise. You know going in everything that's going to happen. It's all there. And it's all laid out pretty plainly. But
I was surprised by the twist where he saves Hitler at the end. But the fact that it comes from Mel Gibson is not surprising.
Right.
One of the three Best Picture nominees that I have not yet seen.
I see. Yes. Well,
with Fences.
I think you're in for a treat.
Yeah.
Because of the story, I'd not known about it either. And I was surprisingly moved by it in moments. I'm like, it was a good film. I thought Mel Gibson did a great job. I thought, I mean, you have his typical things that he likes to do with music and with blood.
Right.
And severed limbs. But I think that at the same time, here's a story about a guy who is staying true to himself and what he believes. And he's not going to back down. And that's actually the thing I think I liked most.
Yeah.
All the way to the end, he stayed tried and true to what he felt like he was called to do in the world.
I will admit that the first act of the movie, for me, was a climb. You know, it was like, okay, yeah, now's the part where we do this.
Exactly.
Now's the part where he has a gal to go back home to. You have to lay a certain amount of bedrock, and I get that. It was a little bit standard Hollywood leading up to the big moments, but when the big moments came, they're these 10-ton bricks.
And it even felt that way. I mean, even the style of the filmmaking felt that way. I felt like the first act was very, oh, this is an epic.
That is a skill I've noticed of Mel Gibson. If you look back through his body of work, directing-wise, he's good at taking big crowds of people that need to do very messy, complicated things and kind of corralling that crowd.
Right.
That's something really specific. That's something that not everyone is cut out for, and Mel Gibson manages it.
Jeff, I'm curious. I mean, I know you haven't seen Hacksaw, but what are your thoughts about Mel Gibson as a filmmaker, as a director?
I've never been, I think, a huge fan of Mel Gibson, the director. I wrote a lot about The Passion of the Christ for Entertainment Weekly when that came out. And I had very complicated feelings about that movie, more specifically about how he marketed it and how he, whether he took seriously the concerns of people who were rightly concerned about the content of that film and how it might affect the culture and society here and abroad. And I also did not like how he seemed to be pitting, I would say, evangelical Christians and Christians in general against the rest of society, especially Jewish people who had concerns about the film.
Yeah.
That really kind of alienated me. But that film, along with Braveheart, you know, he is a great filmmaker in terms of how he creates images and sound and the visceral quality of the experience that he's capturing. But I also think it's beholden to a lot of cliches.
right.
about masculinity and all sorts of other things that I find problematic.
And I think that's what I was maybe reacting to, especially in that first act. I wasn't personally invested in the girlfriend slash wife. And she was kind of a prop, let's be honest, and those kinds of things. So that he would have a photo in his wallet while he saved the world. What are you going to do? Next up, David McKenzie, Hell or High Water. Jeff, what was your impression of Hell or High Water?
You know, I like this film a lot. It's kind of stuck with me. I actually just watched it a couple of days ago. I just love the lean, mean, focused screenplay, the very sharp direction, the very well-drawn characters, the whole neo-Western noir of it all. What trips me up and stops me from saying it's a great movie is that as well-made as it is, as much as I liked it, it reminded me of a lot of other things that I like that are like it, you know. Right. But, you know, it was great to see Chris Pine in kind of like in a different kind of performance and a different kind of film for him. I love how Jeff Bridges continues to find endless different variations on sort of the gruff, grumbly, marbled mouth, cowboy character.
Yeah. So true.
He has 11 different settings of grizzled.
Right. You think you've seen him play this character before, but I actually think that he gives you something different from True Grit. But I like it a lot. I hated the fact that the ending is very haunting, but I hated how it went out on a song. I don't know about you.
Interesting. My least favorite part of that film was the song that it went out on. Yes. I was like, oh, you could have nailed it, but that final song was awful.
With the right song cue, that becomes like an unforgettable, searing ending, you know? Yeah. But I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Yeah.
I mean, what do you think? Why that choice of song?
I don't know. That's the thing. It's still a mystery to me because I'll be just baldly honest. I loved Hell or High Water. I thought it was great. It was one of the first nominee films that I saw. And from the start, it was kind of almost like my dark horse pick. I was like, oh, I hope this is it. I love the screenplay. Much as I thought Chris Pine did a great job, he was far and away outclassed by Ben Foster, who was just astonishing performance. Yeah. Everything Ben Foster does is he's in it all the way. That screenplay was razor sharp. Yep. Not a complex movie. That's almost not really the point. I felt like, and maybe this is a little bit what you were talking about, Jeff, but I like the fact that it felt like I was getting this itch scratched that was left behind from No Country for Old Men or something like that. I wanted more quality movies like that, and I felt like I got one. I don't think it's on the level of No Country, but it still did the job for me. I don't know. I don't know how else to put it. It was just a really solid film. It kind of worked on this sort of strange, abstract, intellectual level as well that just spoke to me. I don't know.
Yeah, I really liked it from the very beginning of the film, and I think that's one of the things I so enjoyed is that it wastes no time. It's like the exact opposite of Hacksaw Ridge in that way.
Right.
The film begins where it should. You know, it's like that old, what is it, that you write all this and then no, you should probably start about 20, 30 pages in. Mm-hmm. And that's what this film does. And I think it's a criticism I've heard from friends who've watched it that they wish they would have gotten to know the characters a little bit more. But I love what I got to know about the characters and what they were doing together. That there's this exploration in these crazy chaotic circumstances. Like, that's what they got. You didn't need to see all their history. You didn't need to see these brothers being brothers before. What you needed to see was them in this moment. And you actually got a whole world of history, I think, in these.
Oh, I totally agree with that. Yeah, the script, the filmmaking tells you everything you need to know about the characters. And then the acting kind of fills in all the blanks while constantly moving forward and never breaking stride toward its sort of almost inevitable, fateful, but still kind of very surprising and devastating ending.
Yeah.
The film leaves you in, for lack of a better word, a situation. It's a pretty neatly crafted situation. To me, it was actually a satisfying situation.
Which is why the song really made me mad. Because what I really wanted to do at the end of that movie is sit in that situation and think about, okay, what just happened there? What are these two characters doing? What do they want from the situation that they're essentially creating? And I kind of wanted something that accentuated that feeling, this in that moment. Instead, it's like you get this country rock song, and it's just what mood are you trying to ring me out on? It was the one false move of the movie, I thought.
Yeah, I would agree with that. So, next one up, Theodore Melfi film, And of course, that's Hidden Figures. Daniel, I can tell by the look on your face that you've got thoughts on Hidden Figures.
I got thoughts I don't want to share.
No,
I mean,
you need to share them.
I need to share them.
What, are you a racist? No.
Yeah, well, now you got to share them.
No, honestly. I mean, I watched this with my wife, who absolutely loved it.
Yeah.
I watched it. It was over, and I thought, okay, this is a good film. No, actually, that's not what I said. This is a fine film. Like, yeah. It was interesting. It was a story that I'd not been aware of before.
Right.
So I appreciated that. I found myself really surprised that it was nominated for Best Picture.
Yeah, well, I mean, I had a similar reaction to it. You know what? I'm not going to be as polite as you. For me, it was kind of the... It was the Brooklyn of this year. It was a nice movie. The first 5 minutes of the movie, you knew beat for beat what right. was going to go on throughout the rest of the movie. And I enjoyed those beats, genuinely.
Yeah.
I did. Similar to Hacksaw Ridge, you can't really screw up that story. It's too good of a story.
It's true.
It's a story, though, that's about essentially defying a system. Brilliant people making terrific progress. And I wanted that sort of spirit to be in the screenplay and in the filmmaking and all that. And it really wasn't. It was nice performances done in a nice, predictable way. You know, I know what you're saying, though. There's a struggle. You feel like you can't really say that, though, because...
No, I don't feel like I can dislike it.
Yeah, we're not really allowed to not like those stories. And I do like that story. I just wasn't thrilled with the way it was told. Did you catch it, Jeff?
Oh, I've seen this one, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So now that we're, you know...
You guys are terrible.
We're such assholes.
You're such... Look, I really like this movie. I definitely... Sounds like I liked it a lot better than you. And it's certainly better than Brooklyn.
It is better than Brooklyn, to be fair.
And you know what? And what I liked about it was the old-fashioned, almost formulaic quality of it. I mean, it does that... really, really well. And the fact that it is telling a story that is largely like there's very little historical, fictional fabrication to it all, that is telling a very kind of inspiring story about a part of history that I didn't really know about. I appreciate it on that level. I think the acting is great. I thought the old-fashioned quality of it is great. Like, I hear what you're saying, especially in the context of a lot of the movies that we're talking about here today, where they're taking chances with filmmaking or they're taking chances with some innovation, like especially like Arrival or get into like Moonlight or La La Land. Clearly, I do think those films are operating at a completely different level than Hidden Figures, no question. But for what Hidden Figures wants to be and the good that it generates, it is very, very good.
Okay, so I appreciate that because I've not considered that the old fashioned formulaic way of telling the story was to represent even that time and space. So no pun intended, but
nice.
Yeah, I like that. That's nice.
Good. Yeah, very good.
Ladies and gentlemen.
I'll be here. I'll be here all night. Yeah, so that kind of makes me see in a different way. And then when you were saying that, it made me think of the whole, I mean, mathematics and science being such a specific thing, that yes, this is a very straight story. This is a very people working with facts and systems and numbers that are very specific. I don't know. It just makes me think about it in a different way.
Yeah. With that said, there are some things that bug me. I mean, I think the Kevin Costner character is a little too white hero-y in the movie. Like the whole moment where he destroys the bathroom sign and all of a sudden there's like, no, he's desegregated like bathrooms at NASA.
It was so fast. It was so fast.
He did. Kevin Costner did it.
But still, I liked it a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, so moving on. Damien Chazelle. And his film, La La Land.
So, Jeff, I'm aware, I think from a Facebook post that you enjoyed this, right?
I really like this movie a lot. And I've since read several articles that seem to tell me that I shouldn't like it as much as I do. But I was taken by the style, by the chemistry between the two central characters and the Ryan Gosling and especially the Emma Stone performance. I liked the music. I thought it actually presented a view of Los Angeles that made me actually like Los Angeles for a change, which is kind of hard to do, while still kind of being kind of realistic and real about its grimier realities. I think that the thing that pushed me over the edge to really loving it is probably something that we can't talk about, which is the ending. The choices that they make at the end of that film and the way that they're presented. Like if it had made any other choice it's maybe not as good of a film. It sort of goes next level with the choices it makes at the end. I love the style of it. I love the sort of like lo-fi musical aspect of it. It doesn't bother me that they really don't know how to dance or that they really kind of aren't great singers. I think that there is a very valid critique that I've read from other people, specifically the New Yorker critic Richard Brody, who kind of really takes it to task on a couple levels. One, in terms of its like treatment of jazz, which I just kind of recuse myself because like I don't know anything about jazz, so this movie can get away with murder about how it treats jazz, and I wouldn't know the difference.
As in, like it's a bad representation of jazz.
Or? Yes, yeah,
really,
yeah. I encourage you to go and read his article, kind of like you know analyzing it and deconstructing it along those lines. And separately, I think there's a valid critique about its sort of depiction of artists, especially the absolutist nature of the Ryan Gosling character and whether or not the film is promoting their their perspective like and their artistic pursuit and whether or not it's a good thing or bad thing. Or is it sort of interrogating the values of absolutist art and kind of pursuing your dreams to the hilt without compromise? Or is it questioning kind of like the value of that? So I like thinking about those things. I would say that that debate is contained within the movie. I liked it for all those reasons.
Yeah. I'll weigh in right now. I loved La La Land.
Loved it.
I thought it was absolutely fantastic, fantastic film. I think what I loved about it was everything that you mentioned, Jeff. It felt to me like it was way more a story about Los Angeles. It's the Los Angeles that I think is kind of a hard to communicate Los Angeles to people that don't really live here. You know, what's the intersection of dreams and art and commerce and reality? And when is it time to just give up? And is that ever a thing that it's okay to do? Or should dreams trump everything? I mean, these are honest questions that the movie asks. And honestly, I feel like of all the cities in the world, no question is being asked louder than in Los Angeles. I mean, this is where people come from all over to ask those questions. And to me, that was the character of the film. Completely agree. Those ending, what was it, 10 minutes?
Yeah.
The movie was built for the ending 10 minutes. And I'll admit, I went into the film with some cynicism. I had heard some great things from some people. I had heard some, you know, some really cynical things from other people. I said, you know, I'm going to go into it cynically. It's a musical that's not necessarily by default my genre of choice. All right, let's see. I'll give it a day in court. By the time I got to those last 10 minutes, it had won me over. I was like, you know what? This is it. This is solid. And then the final 10 minutes happened. And I thought, no, this is more than just solid. This is transcendent. This is a piece of art that is important. Really, really genuinely blown away by La La Land. I'm actually grateful for it.
That's awesome. So I feel so much differently than you guys do.
Good.
I've been really wrestling with it and thinking about, okay, why didn't it resonate with me or connect with me immediately? And I don't know if it was because of the musical aspect or, but there was something about it that I don't know if it's a matter of preference. Like, this is a question I'm still thinking about. It's actually, it ends up higher, I think, on my list than I thought it would, because after what all the other films I've seen since. But the ending, and I think it has something to do with what you said, Jeff, with regard to the absolutist and the pursuing artistic dreams and all those things, that was hard for me to connect with. So where that then goes with the ending was actually really tough for me. So when I get to the end, I'm like, I don't know why there's a disconnect. Then someone, we had a conversation, he was like, man, I really resonate with the Ryan Gosling character. And because of all of these questions that they kind of, that these characters seek to ask and the struggle that they seem to go through and then the choices that they end up making. And I was saying to the son, but I actually think your story is more interesting to me in that you kind of were asking all these questions and you were wrestling with all the, in all these ways, but yet you've struggled to be in a relationship and to have children and to allow the relationship itself to actually change or shape your dreams and your pursuits. That I think to me, that's what frustrated me about the ending.
Right. So I hear what you're saying, and I don't disagree with it. The movie kind of presents at the end a seemingly like a binary choice, right? It's either this or this. And a proper rejoinder all that is that there isn't a third option. Right. There isn't a fourth option. And I definitely thought about that. That's true. But at the same time, I'm not exactly sure that the movie is saying that there aren't other options, or that we can't consider other options in our own discussion of it. Like, for these characters, these were the options.
That's fair. Okay.
And I can allow for more options in our conversation about it. At the same time, I think that that critique is totally fair.
Yeah.
And this is the power of that movie, is I haven't stopped thinking about it.
Right.
Yeah, they present you with these characters that make this choice, and why do you wish it was different? Why do I wish it might have been different? Listening to Damien Chazelle's desire for wanting the music to be as gritty as it was, but still kind of have this jazz flavor, made me love the film more. So he wanted people who were able to be human beings and almost talk through song, which makes me want to see the movie again, kind of with that in mind, because I don't think I was getting that from what I was watching, because I didn't even know to look for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one thing I would say about La La Land compared to maybe every other film on this list, it's the one that is the least flattered by our current cultural moment. I mean, the idea that it's just a movie about these two Hollywood dreamers in their own little bubble pursuing their dreams to the fullest. I can allow for this movie to exist in our culture, but at the same time, you know, it isn't grappling with a lot of very specific big picture issues and or general themes that currently embroil us in our current political moment.
Yeah. Wasn't that so nice to go there for a couple of hours?
But yes, I would now. And in that way, maybe it actually is perfect for a moment, because I definitely enjoyed the escape of it all.
Yeah.
Which is why it might actually win.
It may win.
Because people feel the exact same way.
We'll find out. So next up is a freshman film, as it turns out,
yes,
from director Garth Davis, and that film is Lion.
Loved Lion.
Yeah.
Because it's a true story, and maybe it resonated a lot, but then also I actually thought the way that he directed the film, given the content of the story, was really well done for me. I liked most of the performances. There's one character that I thought, for me, I kind of felt a little bit detached from, but I think that might have been the point of that relationship, and I don't want to give too much away. I didn't know anything about this film going into it. I did not know what it was based on, didn't know it was a true story about this kid who was lost. It was a powerful depiction of family and love and pursuit and searching for that and for where home is and where you belong in the world.
And I think that's the way to go into Lion, honestly, because I knew next to nothing about it also. I really enjoyed it. And actually, I had no idea it was a true story. I will say that at about the halfway point, the thought came into my brain, this better be a true story or I'm going to be pissed.
Right. No, that's a valid point.
I mean, not every single moment worked flawlessly for me, but the overall picture, a powerful story, Nicole Kidman's speech that she gives about, you know, we had a choice and we chose you. There's really no more powerful sentiment, I think, in the world, especially when you're talking about a relationship with a child. That's something that transcends the movie. There's certain films I feel like, yeah, this is great, and you should watch it. And then there's other films that I'm like, this is something that should almost be taught or something.
Right.
It's how I felt about like The Big Short last year. Mm-hmm. It's so funny to compare Lion with The Big Short, but but I felt like this is something that teachers should show to their students or something, to say, look, this is a thing that you need to understand about the way the world works. Before you continue on, know this. And that's what Lion sort of did for me. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I thought it was very beautifully done.
And I think one of the more positive depictions of technology and what it actually makes possible. You see so many movies about technology and how it's bad and how it does, you know.
We've talked about this in past episodes, Daniel, where there are certain films that can only take place in a certain time in a certain place.
Yes.
Lion can only take place in the first decade of the 21st century. That's the only time that could happen.
And that's what's crazy, is the story had to have happened then for it to actually be possible for what happens to happen.
Such an ambitious, successfully ambitious start for Garth Davis.
Top of the Lake. He directs some of the episodes in that show, and he deals with environment and location in such a beautiful way in that show, and I think in Lion as well.
I can't wait to watch it. You've sold me on it.
However, you know, whatever you might think of the film, I mean, you know, this is the Freshman 15, so root for Garth Davis.
I know, you have to.
You're an Oscar winner in our hearts. Daniel, your guy, Kenneth Lonergan.
Kenneth Lonergan.
Manchester by the Sea.
I'm a Kenneth Lonergan guy. I mean, so yeah, I picked You Can Count on Me as my favorite freshman film. Man, I love Manchester. I love Manchester for the same reasons I actually liked, or no, I loved Steve Jobs. There was no character in any of these films that I felt like I knew better than Lee, played by Casey Affleck in Manchester by the Sea. So I loved this film so much. I loved the writing. I loved the acting. I thought there were some really interesting decisions made directing-wise and even editing-wise that helped me kind of understand this story, this disconnection, or this wanting to hold in things, and this almost repression. So yeah, I love Manchester by the Sea so much.
Yeah,
Manchester by the Sea was an interesting journey for me. I saw it with my girlfriend and we watched it on screener. It was a little late. I think we were a little tired. We got about an hour and 40 minutes into it and we kind of said, you know, how much longer is this film? It was another 45 minutes. I'm like, maybe we should take a break. So we came back to it a couple days later. And not how I would recommend watching Manchester by the Sea at all. That sort of the disjointed way that I experienced it definitely probably didn't do it a lot of favors. That said, it's still my second favorite film on this list. The Casey Affleck character is really powerful. The style, the nitty gritty attention to kind of like the everyday way that these people in this community live their lives, the portrait of this community. You feel like you know these people.
Yes.
You feel like you know this place. You feel like you live in this place. It's pretty remarkable in that way. It's a movie about tragedy. It's and grief and moving past that. A lot of people say it's depressing. I think we talked about this. At the same time, it's a very funny movie.
Yeah.
And it's ultimately, at its heart, a very optimistic movie in that it kind of is this portrait of incremental thawing of a heart over time that leaves us with no certainties about whether or not this guy and this boy that he's now taking care of, they'll turn out well. It captures your imagination for how they may turn out well and in a way that we can all really relate to. So it's almost like this aesthetic exercise in how to dramatize a very different way of thinking about grief and recovering from it. I just, that sort of very rigorous point of view, it's very powerful in that way.
Yeah, without a doubt. That really stuck with me, Jeff. You mentioned the humor of it.
Mm-hmm.
That was the part that I wasn't really prepared for because I thought, okay, here it comes. In fact, you know, my wife and I went in to see it. She brought Kleenex. She said, I'm ready.
She did.
Oh, yeah. It was all, she said, come on, do it to me. What do you have? and we found ourselves laughing.
That's
and
great.
It had this sort of spirit. I kind of compare it in some ways to the David O. Russell film, The Fighter.
Okay.
Powerful, powerful story that's just laced with a really specific brand of humor. It's just this kind of Boston flavor. Well, first of all, the movie couldn't take place anywhere else.
Nowhere else, I know.
It only works there. You have a certain flavor of personality there. Those hilarious moments make the grief deeper.
Yeah.
You're not just watching people who are grieving, but you're watching friends and neighbors that you've gotten to know. Boy, oh boy, the Michelle Williams scene.
Oh my goodness.
A crusher. Just an absolute crush.
Like how many, you could count on one hand how many scenes that she has.
I know.
But the scenes that she has are just so searing, right. So specific, so intense. She earns that Oscar nomination.
Oh my gosh, she does. I know.
There was such authenticity in that in that moment. It is a film about grief, and we already know that this is territory that Kenneth Lonergan has tread in the past. He writes characters with enough dimension. It defies this temptation we have to pin down a character.
Yes, for sure.
The son, you know, you want to say, okay, but is this kid an asshole? Or, okay, got it, he is an asshole. Oh, hang on.
Yeah.
He's not. Oh, well, hang on over here. And then you realize there's the humanity inside the movie because no one is exactly any one thing. You know, in our most recent episode, Daniel, you and I talked about with Errol Morris, you know, what is the truth underneath these people? These are layered individuals.
Absolutely.
And you have to assess for yourself. And I feel that in every moment and every character that Kenneth Lonergan creates.
So Lee's presented with what seems to be two options, a yes or a no. Part of the hopefulness in the film is that he's willing to actually create a third way that works, which was so moving to me in the sense of what he's attempting to deal with in this place that he cannot bring himself to be in for any length of time.
Yeah, I mean, by the end, what's powerful, he is recognizing that there is an event that is occurring in his heart, that there is a change that is happening. Maybe that change will stop dead in its tracks, or maybe it will continue and take him someplace that is better than where he is now. Mm-hmm. That we kind of leave him in that place was great. It offers a sort of like portrait or a philosophy about change that I think we need to hear right now in our culture, in the sense of like what we want instant change, instant transformation, instant transcendence and fixing right now in terms of the problems that face us, the things that need to be worked out. That's not what's going to happen. It's about a slow working out over time. And how faithful are you going to be to that process? How diligent are you going to be to that process? Are you going to see it through? I love this movie for embodying that idea.
Thank you for that. That's a good way of describing it.
The next film, final film, is of course from writer-director Barry Jenkins. The film is Moonlight.
Jeremy?
Yeah.
What did you think of Moonlight?
What did I think of Moonlight? One of the things that I was intent on preparing for tonight was the, you know, my rank, my ordered list. First, second, third, fourth, you know, all nine films. And I found that the list kept shifting around in my head. And I realized the consistent element was Moonlight kept jumping up a notch each time that I remade the list. The film just nagged at me. Do I like the film? Do I love the film? It was a film that I kind of woke up thinking about, you know, and I mean literally, I would wake up in the night and there would be a scene or a moment from the film.
Wow.
It was so specific and so intense. And I was... Ultimately, one of the issues that's discussed in the film is sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
The discussion that I was really happy that the film provokes is the fact that we live in this kind of society with this binary view of sexuality. On the one side, you have this idea that like sexuality is a choice and, you know, you need to make the right choice. And on the other hand, it's like, no, sexuality isn't a choice. We are who we are and that's it. And that's how it goes. And I feel like Moonlight makes the case for something that is neither. People are maybe a little bit more complex than that. Now, whether you agree with that or not, it's something to discuss. Maybe this is being too specific about the film, but to me, it's such an interesting discussion that it introduces.
Yeah, I love this movie. It's great in so many ways. I mean, I love the structure of the movie as these essentially like these three interlinking short films, each of which are like just beautifully, precisely considered. There's not a wasted shot. It's directed and told with this sort of like lyrical, poetic storytelling. Barry Jenkins, the filmmaker, his influences were European films, and I think it totally shows in terms of its approach to character and visual and music and lighting and all of that.
I didn't even know that, but that makes sense.
Yeah, and it's brilliantly cast. The themes of identity and race and sexuality that are explored without really kind of like saying anything about them, and how all those three pieces work together to kind of build. And then that beautiful ending, I mean, it's like it's a coming of age tale, I guess, in a way. Yes, it's about a gay man. But it's ultimately just like it's asking questions about where are we learning our ideas about masculinity and sexuality, and what happens when we have to learn them on our own, or we have to invent them on our own, when those considerations are corrupted and manipulated by cultural forces and other people.
Mm-hmm.
And the beautiful, shattering, wonderful ending of that movie is that this man has come to a place where he can finally start dealing with that stuff honestly and openly. It's just great. My struggle with the movie is that I think that the first two portions of it are just really, really good. There's just like everything mm-hmm. is almost perfect about them. The third part of it, the climax of it all, is really this acting duet between the adult versions of the two key young characters.
Right.
But it doesn't feel like there's enough material in that third part to earn a lot of the amazing turns that we see at the end. I don't know if that resonates with you guys without giving a lot of away. Sure. But nonetheless, this is just an exceptional movie.
And I think that thing that you just described, Jeff, is exactly the thing that was keeping me up at night. Was
interesting.
What is this need that I have for a fuller resolution? Resolution's even the wrong word, but just that third act. Is there a way to fill that out more? And even that struggle is what kept pointing me back to the structure of the film itself. It made me wonder, did Barry Jenkins want me to struggle with this?
Right.
And there's a side of it that I think he did.
Yeah, there's something to be said about movies. Oftentimes I find when we talk about movies and we appraise a movie, the struggle that we have with the movie is actually the thing that's beautiful about the movie.
Right, right.
And that we often think about art, that artists are making statements versus asking us questions and leaving us questions. We as an audience, we don't do that well. We don't like to be left with questions. We like to evaluate things based on, here's an artist making a statement. What do I think about this? As opposed to an artist expressing questions, either as questions or statements as questions, and asking us to kind of like wrestle with that and make up our own minds about things.
Sharon, I think that's his name, right? Sharon, at the end of the second act, what he starts doing when he wakes up, right? He starts putting his face in a sink of ice, which actually connects it to the third act. Like, he needs to reset himself. You kind of sense, or at least I sense, there's been a constant resetting of self that I get to the end and I'm like, the questions that we might have for him, he has for himself. I love Moonlight. And for all the reasons that you guys mentioned, I love that it has such a mature view of sexuality. You would think you know where it's going at the end. And that's the transcendent moment for me, actually, is that it transcends what you think where it's going and what that would offer is actually not what he needs.
Absolutely.
I absolutely love that. The other thing I loved, and it, the simplicity in directing, the thing I kept noticing throughout the film is that the world is constantly swallowed up by bodies. Like, in the actual visual style. Like, it's almost like everything is suffocated by people. And it's such a first-person film that I can't help but think that's how he feels. Like, he loses almost a sense of himself in reference to other people, and so these other people become so large and so big. Such a simple story, but so complex, at least in the way that of what it's dealing with and what it's exploring.
Yeah, yeah. I was just so mesmerized by Mahershala Ali.
Oh my goodness.
Powerful, powerful actor, and he makes every single second on screen count.
Also in Hidden Figures.
Hidden Figures, that's right.
I was surprised to see him in there.
Small role, but an effective one. But he is sensational in Moonlight. Absolutely. I mean, I've seen him in a lot of different things over the past couple of years in a role that could have been drug dealer with a heart of gold, you know, yeah. Basically. The conflict that he brings to it, the things that go unsaid,
yeah.
That absolute heartbreaker of a scene with him and the boy just sitting in their shame and anger with each other, that was pretty amazing. This is like a redemptive use of film.
Yeah.
That he's making a movie that feels so personal, mm-hmm. yet so universal in this sort of like lovely way we need more filmmakers making more movies like this.
You know, absolutely. Absolutely. 9 films. So fellas. Oh,
you're going to do it.
It's part of the drill here. But I'm curious, what are your picks for Oscar 2017 this Sunday? What do you think?
Are we ranking our movies? Or are we predicting what's going to win?
Let's start with what you think is going to win.
What I think is going to win is La La Land. I think every indicator seems to say that we are moving toward this. I think that a lot of these films are going to get honored and reflected in many ways, especially the top three. La La Land, I think, will clearly win several awards. I think that Manchester by the Sea is going to definitely win Best Actor for Casey Affleck. How do you honor Moonlight? is going to be one of the big questions and tensions of the evening. If Ali doesn't win Best Supporting Actor, then I'm rooting for it to win Best Picture.
It sounds like your personal pick for Best Picture would be Moonlight.
So, I don't know. It's La La Land, Manchester by the Sea, and Moonlight in this cruel death match between all three of them.
Now, you said you're not a member of the Academy, but if you were...
If I was a voting member of the Academy, what would I vote for? Dang.
Oh, wow.
I don't know. Like, I think that I would break the tie by giving it to the one that I think would benefit the most by winning.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Which is Moonlight.
Moonlight. Yeah, okay.
But like I said, like if I voted my heart, it would be a three-way tie.
Right.
The director and cast of La La Land are going to go on and do other films and other things. Kenneth Lonergan and the cast of Manchester by the Sea will do just fine.
Sure.
That's good. Yeah.
Barry Jenkins needs support.
That's awesome. That's a good. I like that argument.
Yeah, without a doubt. Okay. So the cruel question here, you have why did this one get nominated? You have a bottom.
Oh, bottom. It's not that I dislike any of these films. I guess what I would kind of go to is like Hell or High Water.
Yeah.
Like, I'm glad that we live in a world where that got a Best Picture nomination.
Yeah.
If we lived in a world where it didn't get a Best Picture nomination, I would be okay with that world too. You know, it's a good film. Like, oh, I'm glad that like the Academy remembered that and gave it a nomination.
Yeah.
It is at the bottom of the six that I've seen.
Okay, fair enough. Daniel.
So I have a top three, I have a bottom three, and then I have a fuzzy middle three.
And a fuzzy middle three.
Yeah. Okay, so my number one is going to be Manchester by the Sea.
Mm.
I can't think about this other than the films I resonated with the most and the films I like most. My second is going to be Moonlight.
Okay.
My third, I think, is going to be Arrival.
Mm.
The fuzzy middle three for me are Lion, La La Land, and Hell or High Water.
Okay.
So my bottom three is going to be Fences, and then it's going to be Hacksaw Ridge, and then Hidden Figures.
Okay.
The top and the bottom seem pretty clear to me.
Yeah.
But those middle, I like them. I like them a lot.
Oh, makes sense. In true dramatic style, I can count them down, if that's how everyone feels.
Do it.
Do it.
Drama, please.
Okay. Nine, and this surprises no one, is, of course, Hidden Figures. And I can't stress enough that I don't feel it's a bad film. I actually feel it's a good film. In fact, I'm going to go so far as to say...
You should watch it.
Watch Hidden Figures. It's worth seeing. At the very least, it's a story that should be told and learned. That's number nine. Number eight, I gave number eight to Fences.
Okay.
Enjoyed Fences, but I couldn't escape the fact that I would have rather seen it on a stage than on a screen. That's where it fell for me. Seven, and probably because of the first act is what held me back with having it be higher, was Hacksaw Ridge. I think you're right, Jeff, about certain aspects of Mel Gibson's direction. Again, a story that is worth telling. People should see it, but that was my number seven. Number six, and this is where we get into the difficult territory, because where does it all fall? I actually gave to Arrival.
Okay.
I wanted so badly to just absolutely love Arrival, but I had to admit in the end that I didn't love it. I just liked it a whole lot. Mm-hmm. Number five, Lion. I think that if people understood the story underneath Lion, we would have more foster care. We would have more attention paid to children that don't have attention paid to them. Well done, film. Beautiful freshman film.
Yeah,
good Lord.
Very beautiful.
Number four, from the start, I wanted this to be high on the list. Hell or High Water. I love the film. It did that thing for me. I go to movies for. Damn that last song. You know, it made me so furious.
Maybe it'd be number three if it wasn't for that
it
song.
It might. Jeff, you and I have similar feelings on it. The final three is just, you know, how do you rank them? Because they're all just so solid. I did give number three to Moonlight.
Okay.
I can't get this film out of my head. The questions. I want to have a Moonlight conversation with everyone I see. Because it's an important film. It needs to be seen. It needs to be talked about. So number two, I gave to Manchester by the Sea.
Yeah.
Kenneth Lonergan.
That's a good spot, though. Okay.
Oh, it's fantastic. There's something about La La Land that I couldn't escape. It was just so true to the character of this place that the three of us live in.
Right.
Los Angeles is something that is kind of in the DNA of the soil. And so many of us, and certainly true with me, I was not born here. But I think that's partly why I appreciate La La Land so much, is because I know what it is to be a person who dreams about LA and then comes here.
Yeah.
That's, to me, the character of the movie. So I deeply, deeply responded to it. So I'll admit it, La La Land is the one that I'm hoping takes home the big prize.
I'm glad.
Yep.
So, you know what? That's it. Needless to say, what we have to say about the Oscars is not going to affect the final result. And
well,
of course, we're going to find out.
We don't know about that.
Why do we have this conversation?
Yeah, totally.
We don't speak too soon.
I mean, you never know.
You're such a pessimist.
You never know. There is a Daniel Long contingent in the Academy, I'm sure, that's been waiting for you to weigh in. But listen, Jeff Jensen, thank you so much
for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It was great fun.
I would love it if you could join us again sometime.
Please.
This would be a lot of fun.
I would love to be here.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, that's it for this special episode, this Oscar episode of The Freshman 15. We want to thank you for joining us on behalf of Daniel and myself.
Thanks for listening.
Happy Oscar weekend.
Bye.